And then something happens. And this is the second stage, which she describes as a stage of quiet. And this is the meditation practice that she did was the prayer of the quiet. I like the whole image of light upon light. Light rises towards light and light comes down upon light and it's light upon light. Light rises towards light is our aspiration, our commitment. And it is actually a light. You can see it in a human being. It's like a spark. It's like a little bit of light. And you work on it and it grows. There's a nice story about somebody who went to visit a Sufi sheikh. He didn't know the Sufi sheikh and he came to the village where he was and knocked on his door and his wife was at home and he said, you know, where's the sheikh? And he said, well, he's at a funeral. And he said, well, how will I recognize the sheikh? And the wife said, because you'll see that everybody going towards the funeral has a light above their head and only the sheikh has a light above his head coming back from the funeral. Because going to the funeral, everybody remembers their mortality and thinks of God. But when they come back from the funeral, they're already engaged in their worldly thoughts. And so their light is no longer there. But the sheikh is, of course, always praying, always remembering God. So his light remains. And it is a light, spiritual light, either in the heart or above the head of a human being, that is your aspiration. It's a light of your divine nature that actually becomes more visible, gets stronger, the more you practice, the more you remember. When you pray, light rises. Your light goes up. It looks towards God. The light of your divine nature looks towards God. At the beginning, that's all you experience. And it's only a little light. We have a little aspiration, and we have a little light that glows. But there is light comes down upon light. There is the light that is given, the grace that is given. And this is the real miracle of the path. This is the real mystery of mystical life, is what is given, is that your aspiration attracts the light of your soul or the light of God, depending how you like to see it. That is why it is said, you take one step towards him, he takes 10 towards you. From the higher source, from your spiritual center, if you look towards the light looks towards you. It comes down to meet you. I can't describe how much of a mystery this is. Most people in life, they have to struggle on their own. They get a little bit of help, but mostly, apart from their friends and family, they're left on their own. But the moment you turn towards God, God turns towards you. And this is very, very evident in prayer and meditation. Because you can only be taken there. You can't do it through effort. Yes, you can actually still the mind through effort. It's interesting, I've met people who've learned to do that, who've learned to do a certain meditation just through effort. And after a while, it becomes very arid. They can go to a place, for example, of inner peace, of tranquility, where they're not disturbed. And the beginning is great, but after about 20 years, it becomes a little dry. And nothing else comes into that place. It's like an inner place of meditation. I read a Zen book about it. They actually called it Zen sickness, where you just go and sit in this place. And you sit in this place and you sit in this place, but nothing else comes into this place. They say it's not very healthy after a while. And even the body begins to get a bit sick because it's very dry. And we work with grace, we work with the light that is given. And this is when it becomes alive, when it becomes a real mystery that is taking place within you, if you like, a divine birth, this saying of Bysabs, it takes time to make a soul pregnant with God. And this is when the inner mystery becomes alive. You have to do that first stage of recollection, that first stage of commitment to create a place, but then the light begins to come, and then there is this moment when you inwardly begin to experience this light, this grace. Mrs. Tweedy describes it very beautifully when it first happened to her. And so it came, it tiptoed itself into my heart, silently, imperceptibly, and I looked at it with wonder. It was a still, small, light blue flame trembling softly. It had the infinite sweetness of a first love, like an offering of fragrant flowers with gentle hands, the heart full of sweetness and wonder and peace. A still, small, light blue flame trembling softly. That's how it came to her. That's how she experienced this light from above coming into her own heart. Of course, it's different for each of us, but there is this first moment when something comes alive, something is unexpectedly present within us, within our heart, within our meditation. It can just be a softness. Where did it come from? I don't know. It can be a sweetness, a fragrance of flowers, a gentleness. I've described many times, the first time I experienced that when I was lying in meditation, and it was like butterfly wings on the edge of my heart. And those butterfly wings on the edge of my heart filled the whole of my body, the whole of my being, with this incredibly tender love. That didn't come from me, because I didn't know that sort of love. I'd never experienced that sort of love. I didn't. I was brought up in a proper English middle-class family, and that was not part of it. It is that moment when this light from above comes into your heart and it becomes alive. To me, this is the great mystery of prayer, of meditation, really of spiritual life. That something comes alive within you in a way you could never imagine, you could never expect. It is given. It is the beloved. It is love coming into you, touching you. And we all experience it in different ways. It wasn't there before, and you look back in your life, and it came from outside of you. It is grace, it is given. And maybe you just get a few moments of that in your whole spiritual practice. It doesn't matter. Spiritual life is not kind of ranking up how many moments of bliss you have. It is the knowing that something comes to you beyond your expectations, beyond your knowing, from a different source. And once you have experienced that once, nobody can ever take it away from you. You don't believe it, you know it. It's your birthright, you have experienced it. And it changes something very fundamental inside of you. Because after that moment, you know. That's why, in a way, it is so dangerous. The Sufis say, keep away from the lane of love. Because it is very addictive. It's like nothing you ever experienced before. I mean, how did I know? I didn't know anything about love. And suddenly there was this sweetness, this softness. Nothing dramatic. But then just spread from my heart, and it spread throughout the whole of my being. And it's... You can do all the inner work you like, you can do all the preparation, you can do all the fasting, all the asanas, all the hours of stilling the mind, and they mean nothing, because this is real, this is the grace that is given. And this changes our spiritual life, because it turns our attention away from all of the distractions of the world, because what we've been given is so infinitely more precious. That's why real mystical life is so dangerous, because it is so seductive. You don't tell somebody, you have to look towards God. You give them a taste of what that might be, and then what are the attractions of the outer world when you've begun to experience that? The world begins to fall away. And this is the beauty of it. We don't reject the world. That belongs to dry ascetic practices. Yes, there are ascetic practices where you do reject the world. And I know, because I've done them. They're actually quite addictive. You get a certain control over your lower nature, or even over your physical body. There's a certain power in them, in real ascetic practices. But they don't give you more than ascetic practices. Instead, the world falls away and we begin to rest in God. St. Teresa describes this very beautifully in the second degree of prayer. Herein the soul begins to be recollected. Notice she says, it begins to be recollected. It is now touching the supernatural, for it never could by any efforts of its own attain to this. As soon as the soul has arrived thus far, it begins to lose the desire of earthly things, and no wonder, for it sees clearly that even for a moment this joy is not to be had on earth, that there are no riches, no dominion, no honors, no delights that can for one instant, even for the twinkling of an eye, minister such a joy. For it is a true satisfaction, and the soul sees that it really does satisfy. You are given what you really want. It's as simple as that. Yes, there is this testing time, this initial 6, 7, 8, 10 years, however long, it doesn't matter, some people 2 years. Let's see if you're really serious about this, if this is something really important. If you look at, you see all the distractions that come your way to seduce you, to tempt you, the doubts that assail you, but once you've passed that preliminary period, then you begin to taste this other. The Sufi uses the word taste or to smell or to savor because it is a very physical experience as well. It's not just something on the spiritual plane. When I felt this love, it was in my body. I felt the butterfly wings in my heart, the physical experience. That's when it becomes alive. That's when prayer, spiritual practice becomes alive. That is when something is born within you. This everything you longed for begins, you begin to get given. And please remember that mystical life is always a gift. You are given it. And that's why, for example, you can't charge for it, because it is given as a gift. Grace is given. It is always given. It is always a gift. It isn't because of you. It's because of, Sufis say, it's because the beloved wants to give. It's said very clearly in the Quran, in this saying of light upon light, Allah guides to Allah whom Allah will. And you are taken. Yes, you have to do the initial preparation, but then it comes into your heart, it comes alive within your own heart. It's the light from above meets the light of your aspiration. I don't say it is easy. I don't say it isn't a challenge. I don't say it isn't demanding. I don't say you don't have sleepless nights, but there is nothing else you'd rather do. There is nothing else that really matters. And there is, of course, a danger in that, in that we live in a culture in which the world is very demanding. You can't live in this world without being engaged in it. It's not easy just to let go by. On this path, we're not allowed to go to an ashram or a monastery. We have to be in the midst of life, that is, outwardly to be with the people, inwardly to be with God. That is actually one of the, as you know, one of the principles, the Naqshbandi principles. So one has these inner experiences that begin to wake up, that begin to transform oneself, and you are not allowed just to retire within them. You're not allowed just to turn away from the world altogether, which is very seductive and very appealing, because it is so much more beautiful than anything in the world. And the world, at this present time, a beautiful world, but it's full of a lot of difficulties, a lot of demands, and one wants just to go inward, to close the door, to be alone with these states within the heart, to be alone with these states in prayer. And one has to, at times, renounce them to be engaged in the world. So just to be aware of that dichotomy, I'm not going to talk about it in detail now. Spiritual life then changes. Once you've had that initial experience of what St. Teresa calls the stage of quiet, spiritual life changes. In her image of the watering the garden, the gardener, instead of drawing water manually from the well, now has a machine of a wheel and buckets whereby he draws the water with less labor and takes it around the garden with much less effort. It becomes alive, and then you don't look back. Once it becomes really alive, you don't look back. You are drawn, the magnet starts to pull the iron filings. Rumi uses this image of the iron filings seeking the magnet. And once that you're in the energy field of the magnet, it's much stronger than you. And yes, you have to surrender, and you are only drawn into that energy field because you surrender, but so much is given, so much of something quite, quite extraordinary. You really begin to wake up to the mystery of the human heart. I don't think there is a greater mystery. What we have within us, the love, the peace, the silence, the bliss, however those qualities come to you. And in St. Teresa's stages of prayer, then you are drawn from this quiet into the stage of union, which is really from an image of a light. This is light upon light. This is when the light from above meets the light from below. And for the Sufis, this is the stage of merging. This is how it happens within the soul on the Sufi path, is that you begin to merge into the teacher, or the teacher begins to merge into you. And it is union, it is oneness. St. Teresa says, "We cannot enter by any efforts of our own. His Majesty must put us right into the center of our soul and must enter there himself. And in order that he may better show us his wonders, it is his pleasure that our will, which has entirely surrendered itself to him, should have no part in this." Surrender is required, because you have to give up your will to surrender to that will. Bicep said he surrender is the most difficult thing in the world while you are doing it. And once you have done it, it is the easiest thing, because I always think it's so much easier to be surrendered. It's so much less hassle. I mean, imagine you've got this ego with all its demands and clamors, and it wants to do this and this and this and this. And how do you decide? How do you know? And what to live out, what not to live out? And just to be surrendered, just to wake up in the morning and say, "Beloved, how can I serve you better today?" Just to go to bed at night and say, "Beloved, help me to serve you better. Show me how I can be of more service to you." I think it's a simpler way to live. I think one goes back to this core of one's being that really bows down before God. And that is the deepest part of human nature. "Am I not your Lord?" Yes, we witness it. And you bring it into your consciousness. You bring it into the breath. You bring it into your life. It is like an axis by which you live, this attitude of surrender. It is, of course, difficult. Yes, it is very difficult. And we all have particular qualities, particular ideas that are very precious to us. I always say it's easier to surrender stuff, you know, or a good earthquake or tornado will have that effect. It's interesting, actually, in this tornado that's wiped out this whole town, and to listen to some of the people talking, and the story that is said over and over again, and these are hardworking people, they don't have a lot, they're not going to have big savings accounts, they've lost everything. And when you hear them saying, "But my husband or my son or my daughter was safe, and that's just stuff, and it doesn't matter. The love is all that matters." So real, because they're, you know, we can talk about it, but giving up stuff, what does that mean? We may be less attached to our car or whatever it is we're attached to, but these are people who actually experienced it. And the same truth is there, lived in that moment. They lost everything, but their child was okay, and it's that love that matters. That's what matters. And that's that simple, essential truth. That's why it's easy to surrender physical attachments. You know, nothing a good earthquake or a good tornado won't solve. But it is one's values, one's beliefs, one's identity that is much, much more difficult to give up. And we often have a core belief, like, for example, justice, or for Mrs. Tweedy, it was karma. She believed in karma. Or for me, it was the belief in spiritual progress. That was really, really important. I would do anything to feel that I could take another step on the path. That made it worthwhile. It's interesting to look inside yourself and see, what are you really attached to? What belief systems or value systems really matter. And they actually also have to go eventually, because emptiness is emptiness. As Al-Halaj says, when truth has taken hold of a heart, she empties it of all but herself. What actually really matters to you, that, and then eventually the path will confront you with that, or the teacher will confront you with that, or life will confront you with that, and then that belief goes, and the freedom you feel after that's gone is you really don't care anymore. You really, really don't care, because it doesn't matter. Whether you are humiliated, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. You really don't care. That is the freedom. That is actually a very painful surrender. These are the beliefs that give us our identity, that give us our sense of self, that make us feel what is right or what is wrong. Or it is said we are made in the image of God, which is one thing. What we tend to do is to make God in our own image, which is something else. And I really sense that there's nothing wrong with having a good God or a loving God or a caring God. I think it's wonderful. And there are many spiritual practices where you create an image of a very good God, of a beneficial God, of a caring God, of a God who is right and who is just, and all of those positive qualities. Unfortunately, if you really are interested in mystical life, that has to go. It's called traditionally the dark night of the soul. It came through St. John of the Cross's own very powerful experiences, that expression, because he was actually imprisoned by his own monastic brothers, and he was not allowed to take confession. And his very belief system that was so important to him was turned against him. And I always love in this very humorous way, because I'm sure you know the story. He was imprisoned by his monks, and they made fun of him, and they wouldn't allow him to do the sacrament. And then one day, they say, the hand of God left open the door of his cell. And so he snuck out, and then he actually got outside onto the wall of the monastery where he'd been imprisoned. And he was about to jump off the wall when he realized, in jumping off the wall, he'd come into a courtyard. He'd jump into a courtyard, and that courtyard was actually the courtyard of the local nunnery that was next to the monastery. And in his religious belief as a monk, he was not allowed to go into the nunnery. So he had to, at that last moment, am I going to follow my religious belief and not jump into the nunnery in the middle of the night? In fact, he was sensible enough to realize the will of God didn't mind about the laws of monks jumping into nunneries. And so he got that and escaped, and then he actually became the father confessor to St. Teresa's nuns. But the dark night of the soul was all his beliefs had to go. And this is something at some point we get taken, and it's incredibly painful because it is our beliefs. It is what we believe in, even our spiritual beliefs. And we have to surrender them, because surrender means surrender. Everything has to go. Then you are just, the symbol is you are a piece of wax ready to be impressed by the beloved, for the beloved to impress his stamp into. You're just a soft piece of wax, and what is his will is his will. And the Sufism, this happens then, it's called merging. You merge. You can't merge if you are holding on to beliefs. And you are taken by love into this deeper state of love, which is union, which is oneness. That is, of course, an incredible state, begins incredibly deep states of ecstasy, of bliss, of bewilderment, of wonder, of belonging. For me personally, one of the deepest qualities of that is you belong totally. I never belonged in this world. I still don't really understand it. I've been here almost 60 years. I don't really understand what it's all about. I don't understand what people do, what they want. I often say to people, what do people, these young people, What do they want? What are they here for? What is it all about? But there is this incredibly deep sense of belonging to my Sheikh, of just belonging, and it's just, I would do anything for him. It doesn't matter. It's like the only place of refuge, of reverence, of however you call it. And one belongs. You belong with a complete totality. That is one of the qualities of this merging, that how it is for me, for each of us, it is different. As I say, there is love, there is devotion, there is ecstasy, there is bliss, there is peace. And you are part of something much greater than yourself. We live such a confined life within our own little self. And then a door opens into the limitless ocean of the heart, into this limitless ocean of love. And the frog suddenly gets to the ocean rather than the pond. And it is so different, it is so completely other, it is so wonderful. Traditionally, they say that's when Sufism really begins. You're not a real Sufi until you swim in the ocean of unity. In Sufism, this is the stage of Bakar, of abiding in God. In St. Teresa's stages of prayer, this is the stage of union. It's not the final stage, but it's... He brought me to his banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. That's from the Song of Solomon. And you want nothing else but to please your beloved. That is really all that matters. If you go beloved, then your heart is fulfilled. And this mystery happens within you, around you. I don't think it makes life easier. This is a common misconception. And when I, growing up living above Mrs. Tweedy, her life was not easier. If anything, her life was more difficult. Because you still have the demands of everyday life. And people still come knocking on the door and wanting this and wanting that. So I don't think it makes life easier. In some ways, it makes life more difficult because there's such a dissonance between those inner states, that inner deepening awareness and the outer demands of life. But would one want to do anything else? No. Would one want to go anywhere else? No. Does anything matter very much except those deepening states? Not really. The Sufis are known as the people of the secret because this is the deep secret of being a human being. This is the deepest mystery of what it means to be alive, that we are one with God, that we are one with this ocean of love, that we carry this secret within us. These states are our mystical heritage. These are what belong to humanity since the beginning of time. And from time to time, they are lived in different places and different people. And they are lived in the heart. This is the mystery of the heart. This is the prayer of the heart that opens us to these deeper states of being. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved hath withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul failed when he speaked. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. Because, of course, there is this other side after those states of merging when there is a state of separation, and then you cry out. But it is a very different cry to the cry at the beginning when you looked for a God you couldn't find. Then you look for the beloved whom you know, whom you have tasted, and they are different tears that you cry there. Because you belong to God. After that, nobody can take it away. It's not a belief. It doesn't come from outside of you. It's given to you. It's inside of you. You belong to your beloved. There are servants among my servants who love me, and I love them, and they look towards me, and I look towards them. So that is the third stage of prayer, the stage of union.